Today's guest is someone whose creativity and passion are built into the DNA of two of the most groundbreaking musicals of all time. I'm talking, of course, with legendary choreographer, director, and producer Bob Avian. Along with co-creators Michael Bennett and Marvin Hamlisch, Bob adapted the stories of Broadway gypsies hoping to get cast and turned them into A Chorus Line, which ran on Broadway from 1975 to 1990. Bob's first solo credit as a producer was the equally iconic Dreamgirls, starring an unforgettable Jennifer Holliday. Full disclosure, Bob was the choreographer for The Witches of Eastwick, a show I wrote with John Dempsey and which ran on London's West End from 2000 to 2001. Bob joins me by phone today from his home in South Florida. Let's find out what makes him tick and how his incredible talent and diligence have taken him to the top. Mr. Bob Avian, choreographer extraordinaire, thank you for joining me today.
Of course, Dana, anytime.
Well, I have so many questions for you. You, my friend, have been an inspiration for a number of years now, ever since we worked on Witches together. Of course, I knew about you before that, so it was a dream come true for me. So,
well, it was a lot of fun working with you. I wish we could get to do it again.
Well, okay. Let's stir up some trouble sometime.
All right.
Listen, I'm going to start with a couple of fun little questions, and then we'll get into some juicy things. But
okay.
When you were a kid, what was your favorite book to read?
It was Lost Horizon. I always loved that book. And it has stuck with me all these years. I guess I like the theme and, you know, and the search for utopia and et cetera.
The search for utopia. Awesome.
Yeah.
So that's what appealed to you. Did that lead to other books for you ever? Or?
Well, my favorite kind of novel is historical fiction. And I love reading about, you know, kings and queens in Europe and that sort of stuff.
And I think I've asked you this before, but I'm going to ask again for the benefit of those who are listening. If you could play any role, any gender, any age, any vocal range, what
right.
would it be?
Well, I guess for a man, it would be Harold Hill in The Music Man. And if I was picking a woman's role, I'd pick Dolly in Hello, Dolly.
What about Harold? Let's talk about both of them. What about okay. Harold Hill speaks to you?
Well, it's such a well-written role, and he's such a con man, but he's also a romantic figure, and he's got great material, and it's a wonderful show.
It is a great show, isn't it? It's kind of a little piece of perfect, that show.
Yes.
And Dolly, and Hello, Dolly, what about her? What is it that speaks to you?
Well, first of all, it's a comedy role, and she's so endearing and has great numbers again, and the show is built around her, and she's always the jewel on the cloth.
Who wouldn't want to walk down having people singing Hello, Dolly to them?
I mean, absolutely.
We've all sort of, I think, fantasized about being the belle of the ball, and she certainly
yeah.
does.
And I did Hello, Dolly for like a year. I did the international company with Mary Martin where we went to Tokyo and Vietnam, and then I played it in Vegas with Betty Grable. And so, you know, just getting to know the show itself so well, it's a wonderful vehicle.
What were some of the things that you took away with working like with greats like Mary Martin and Betty Grable?
Well, with Mary Martin, it was one of three shows I did with her, and she taught me what a professional is and how important the whole show is around her, not just her. And we changed stage managers so many times, so she and I became the constant, and every night I would go into her dressing room and we'd discuss the show and what looked ragged and what looked good, and she was wonderful. And then playing it with Betty was just coming off her divorce to Harry James, and she was very insecure. But I was impressed with how musical she was. I had no idea she had such a good ear, and she had a great musicality, which was very impressive.
Fantastic. So that idea of it wasn't just her up front headlining the show, especially with Mary Martin.
Yes.
It was a big concept that it took a village, if not an entire city.
Yeah, she was very aware of that. And I did three shows with her. I went in on a replacement in Jenny, but it was very short-lived. And then mm-hmm. I did Dance Captain for Hello Dolly with her. And then I was an assistant stage manager on I Do, and she became my domain. I personally took care of her, coached her on everything, and would go over to her apartment in the morning and would get into a Rolls Royce and drive around Manhattan she would learn the dialogue. You know. So we became great friends. She was an incredible gal.
Well, I love hearing that. You know, she's certainly legendary. And as are you, my friend. And I find folks like you to be so gracious and generous, and you are no exception. One of my favorite things is I was bemoaning, you know, everything when we were working on Witches, you know, I recall that there were times that I felt overwhelmed and slightly like, you know, I was catastrophizing everything, you know, and
right.
I remember they were going to bring a yacht across the stage, and it was at the beginning of the opening number, and of course my spidey sense said, you know, oh my God, why were we stopping the action now, you know,
uh-huh.
to bring a yacht, and they needed more music, and I was kind of bitching to you, Bob, and you said, listen, this is your opportunity to write the best damn water music you've ever written. And then you sort of patted me on the shoulder and said, don't worry, they'll cut it. And they did. Where does that kind of peace come from, Bob?
I guess from doing so many shows, you know, and
uh-huh.
and working with very dynamic people, and or I should say temperamental, that
uh-huh.
you just have to sort of go along with it. And every time you work on a new musical, it is pushing a 2-ton boulder up a mountain.
Right.
And it's a tough go, you know. And here again, Witches was no exception. It was a bumpy ride. But I must tell you, by the time we were in our second year at the Prince... What was it called? Prince of Wales
Theater.
Prince
of Wales, yeah.
It really was wonderful, you know.
Ah, well, thank you. And actually, it was like you and Cameron who kept saying, look, you know, the great shows are rewritten there, you know, and giving me that sense that, you know, you always have another chance to make it good, you know, and that was the thing. It was a little scary for me, you know, and I would imagine young artists especially, it's like, oh my God, I only get one chance. I only get one break. How do you feel about that? Do you feel as if people get a break and that's it?
Sometimes, and sometimes the reverse is true. There were no rules.
Right.
And it's just luck has a lot to do with it, and finding a producer who's willing to do your work. And mm-hmm. it's a crapshoot. You never know, and it's always different.
You know, also, there are so many different places for people in the arts, and especially in theater, that mm-hmm. a lot of people are just not aware of. I think everybody
right.
thinks of it as being a star or being a this or being a that, and there are just so many places for different abilities, and everybody brings something special.
And you know, Dana, I know you spend a lot of time down here in South Florida, but now there is so much going on. It's unbelievable. It's very difficult to keep up with. And some of it is just great. And down here, people are working so much, and it's really eye-opening.
That's exciting to hear. I lived there. I lived in South Florida from 90 to 96, and
yeah.
it was cooking then. I imagine it has really gotten extraordinary. You know,
yeah, there's a lot going on. It's a tremendous
now,
amount.
You spent a lot of time in South Florida, but you're on your way back to the city, aren't you, soon?
Yeah, I spend the winters here. But, mm-hmm. you know, the revivals of my old shows keep calling me back. I go back mid-April to start casting Miss Saigon for New York, the New York revival,
mm-hmm.
which is based on the London revival we just did. And that will be a limited run, basically, and then go ahead out and do a 50-city tour again. And meanwhile, and also during the summer, I'm going out to the Hollywood to oversee a production of A Chorus Line being done out there at the Hollywood Bowl. And
so
here I am, retired for many years, turning down every job, and I'm doing two shows at once.
Yeah. That's fantastic. So, Bob, how did you get started?
Oh, God. I always knew I could dance, but my parents were immigrants and boys didn't dance. And so I never got a formal training. But then I went off to Boston University, and we had a movement course. And in the course, there was this girl dancer from Boston Ballet. She said, come to my ballet school. We need guys. And that was all I need, the tiniest bit of encouragement. And so off I went. And after about a month, I said to the teacher, you know, I can't afford this. I'm paying for class and books and whatever. And the teacher said, just come in as often as you can and don't worry about paying. So at 17 years old, I start trudging off to ballet school, and I went every day, maybe two classes a day. And to repay, I would teach the babies on Saturday morning. And I think I stayed in college the whole 4 years so I could get a dance technique under my belly. And at the end of the 4 years, my ballet teacher said, well, I want to send you off to Germany to be in a opera ballet corps. And I said, but I want to be on Broadway. And sure enough, as soon as I got out of college, I got a replacement job in West Side Story. I could dance, and that was my entree onto the Broadway stage.
If there was like an inner dialogue going on with Bob Avian when you went into West Side Story, what were you telling yourself at that time? What was it that was, you were coaching yourself along in a really fantastic way. What was going on?
I was scared to death. But, you know, luckily, when I was in college, every summer I got to do summer stock. And I always wound up in places that did 6 or 8 musicals a summer. And we were always in rehearsal, and always every week or two we were doing a new show. I tell you, it was the most incredible learning experience I ever had. Mm. And I was like 18 years old then. And, you know, 1 week you'd have a dance solo. The next week you'd have nothing. The next week you'd have a part. And I did this for almost 4 summers. I was going to school. And it's own university. And then I got West Side Story, and I was ready because I had a lot under my belt already. I had done like, 20 musicals. And anytime a door opened, I went through it, and I was fearless that way.
That's a wonderful thing. I mean, to just kind of go, I was scared to death, but I did it anyway, huh?
Yeah. And, you know, when I was a young man, we had a lot of summer stock, and it was great. And we would do all the classic musicals and the operettas, and it was incredible training. They don't have that anymore. You get to do these tours or whatever, but that's about it.
Right. I mean, I remember when I was growing up. Do you remember, were you ever familiar with Kenley Players?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, they did the tours in the summertime, you know, the summertime tours. And that doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, that was
no.
what an outlet that was for actors and creatives. And it was also a wonderful experience for people who got to see those shows with their favorite sort of celebrities and stars.
Yeah. There's a couple of them left, but
are there?
They're not tours. They're regional companies like St. Louis Muni Opera.
Mm-hmm.
But that's 12,000 seats outdoors, you know. But mm-hmm. there's a couple of those around the country and a couple of regional theaters that do musicals. We have a new company down here called the Slow Burn Theater, and it's a wonderful artistic director that's turning out these obscure musicals like Romance, or Big Fish, and he's rethinking them and doing them locally, and he's very talented. That's exciting.
If there was one piece of advice you could give to a young creative, you know, it could be an actor, a dancer, a choreographer, want to be choreographer, someone who wants to do what you do or have done in your life so well, what would that one nugget of wisdom be?
Well, keep training and keep studying and keep getting better. And never give up the training or the coaching. That's very important. And then if a door opens, don't question it. Just go right through it and find out what's on the other side.
I've learned it doesn't open by accident. It's indeed an opportunity, isn't it? And that and I got that from you back in 2000 when we were doing Witches. It's an opportunity, you know. It's not the end of the world.
So. And you have to weigh about working with the best people you can, you know, and learning from them. You know, when Michael Bennett, who was my best friend, and we were both Broadway dancers, asked me to start assisting him. He had done one show in summer stock, but luckily it came into New York. And he asked me to be an assistant on Henry, Sweet Henry. And I was also in it. And because we were so friendly, I was always totally honest with him. And he always respected that. And then he made me his lifelong career associate. And people would keep asking me, why don't you break out on your own? And I said, let me see. If I was breaking out on my own, I wouldn't be working with Harold Prince or Steve Sondheim or Alan J. Lerner or Andre Previn or Burt Bacharach and Neil Simon. I mean, I was being exposed to the biggest guys on Broadway, and I never stopped learning, you know, and to see the joy and the torture of what creating in a musical could be. Because here again, I kept learning. I kept learning. I was working with tremendously experienced people, and then I did do some things on my own. And unfortunately, when Michael Bennett got sick, I was on my own. But Cameron McIntosh grabbed me by the neck or with the hook and dragged me to London, and I was there for the next 13 years.
I know, and the rest is an incredible history. I mean, you know, what was the beginning of that? Follies?
Follies was the first show. And then he said, before we had even started working, he said, I want you to do Miss Saigon. And I said, but we don't know each other. You don't know if we're going to get along. He said, I know. I want you to do Miss Saigon. And I was the first one he hired for that show. I mean, I'm not including Claude Michel and Alain Boubli,
but it was an
honor.
Absolutely.
And we've done 8 projects together. And I did one for Andrew Lloyd Webber when I was there that I thought he was going to produce, but he didn't. And that's how I wound up doing it, which was Sunset Boulevard. But
it's just beautiful, too.
You know, London was very good to me.
If you could go back in time, what advice would you give yourself at the beginning?
Well, I would say don't be afraid of anything and just plunge in. And I was very cautious about certain things, and I shouldn't have been. After Michael died and I started getting offers, that's when I plunged in and not knowing what the heck I was going to do. When Cameron asked me to do Miss Saigon, I went, one is about imperialism, one's about capitalism. What am I going to do? I didn't have a clue, you know, but ultimately, you concentrate and you figure it out and then you do it.
And if somebody were to ask you, what is your purpose? What would you say?
Oh, my God. What is my purpose? I don't know. I guess to make people enjoy and love the theater. I mean, that's where I find my greatest joy. And nothing makes me happier when there's an audience sitting in a theater watching a show that I've worked on and they love it. Or, you know, if they don't, it saddens me tremendously. I've been on both extremes of that, you know, where the audiences have just loved it and where they haven't, you know, and it's very depressing when they don't. But that's what keeps you going, interestingly enough, you know, recognition, trying to culturally and artistically satisfy yourself as well as the audience.
I love that. The audience is your focus. That, I think, is a big key, isn't it?
No one's asked me that question before, so that's what I do think, yeah.
Having been on both sides of that, what is one of your proudest moments?
Oh, golly. I guess, you know what my proudest moment was? I was walking through Leicester Square in London on a rainy afternoon, and I looked at one of those ticket
stores where they sell tickets for London West End shows, and they have all the posters up. And right next to each other was a poster for Miss Saigon, a poster for Sunset Boulevard, and a poster for Martin Guerre. And I went, holy shit, you know. I never thought in a million years I would ever see that, you know. And it was like staggering to me.
It's really wonderful. I just want to take a second to thank you once again for spending time with me and sharing your experience. And it is an honor always. Thank you, Bob.
Oh, thank you, Dana. You are such a terrific guy. I surely appreciate that.
Side effects from listening to Take It From the Top include climbing out of a creative rut, getting inspired, and or living the life of your dreams. If these symptoms persist, tell a friend to download the podcast immediately.